we go on with Plato, Mr. Johnson, when you can sit down?
Very funny to have the preacher
here. Oh, order. The students are all right.
Well, we were dealing with Plato, and with his attempt to do justice both to Heraclitus and Parmenides, and his sympathies are definitely with Parmenides. So real being is absolute or true being, and that's eternal and changeless being. And when Socrates, who is down here, and we're all down here, of course, we are what we are individually because we have separated from that absolute true being, and therefore we've got immersed in non-being. And that gives us our individuality. The principle of individuation is therefore non-rational. On the Christian basis, we are as individuals what God makes us. He relates us to other individuals and to the human species as a whole. But we are as individuals, not what we are because of some principle of non-being, which operates independently of the plan of God. Everything that we are is within the plan of God. But here, you see, an individual is basically in his individuality because he is cut loose, he's disjoined. He is now no longer connected with that eternal true being. Now, there is therefore a sharp distinction between this world, the world of sense, and our experience here, and the world of eternal true being. Now, when Socrates is about to drink the hemlock cup, then you see he's down here, and the argument is, since, as far as my intellect is concerned, I participate in this true being over there, what will happen to me when I die is that my individuality will be lost in that absolute being and will be reabsorbed, or if you want to put it that way, re-frozen into, just like chips of ice off from an ice block. Take a pick, and you take little pieces of ice, and they float in a large area of water. Well, they're as ice, they are made of the same stuff as the old ice block. The only difference is that they're chipped off for the time being, and therefore they can be built in again. Now, that means to the extent that you are real, you're not an individual. You remember that we said yesterday, according to Goethe, if the individual speaks, it is no longer the individual that speaks, because the individual then has been lost into and reabsorbed into that absolute and changeless being. Now, you see that that is the same problem that we already saw with an ex-commander when he said, it's in terms of the beyond that we have to explain the world of sense, of earth, air, fire, and water, and a sense experience here. But who knows anything about that world? We don't as individuals, because when we are up there, before we came into this world, we were up there, but we were not there as individuals. You have no individual consciousness of having been there. You don't know that what is now is Mr. Miller doesn't think that I, Mr. So-and-so Miller, was there as an individual. You can't even say I had just a little tiny block of reality which I could call my own. Now, I saw Mr. Miller's home. It's a modest home as far as size is concerned, compared to the White House. But it is his home, and it's his palace, and it's my home is my palace. And LBJ hasn't got any business to come in there without knocking on the door. And I don't have a whole lot of money, like DuPont has, but this quarter, this nickel, and this bit of change that I have is just as good as if Mr. DuPont himself had a quarter and a nickel. It's the same kind of quarter. Don't you see? My being is the same being as the divine being. There isn't as much of it. That's the stuff. Now, the whole difference is, on the Christian basis, this is God's being, and man's being isn't a little bit of divine being. It isn't the same sort of being, but less of it. Don't you see? Now, Mr. Johnson was asking me a question on the way over from coffee to coffee. He says, now, we too are called scholastics. We are called intellectualists. And by a lot of people today, we Orthodox, particularly we Reformed Christians, are called intellectualists and scholastics. Yes, but don't you see? In fact, they like to call us that. They don't mind this. this is where their own position came from. But don't you see, they call the Orthodox position, particularly the Calvinist position, determinist. Because by God, by his counsel, controls whatsoever comes to pass, he says. And they also call it irrationalist or indeterminist, because God is arbitrary, he says. God elects certain people to eternal salvation, he passes others by. So we're charged with determinism with indeterminism, with rationalism with irrationalism. But actually, in other words, this is the Orthodox Christian position which the natural man hates. It doesn't hate Platonism. Oh, they may reject Platonism. That's an untenable intellectual position. We've gotten so far beyond Platonism. But they don't hate it with a perfect hatred, as they do the Christian position. The natural man is interested in destroying the Christian position, because that reminds him of his sin and of the fact that he is a creature. Here, man is not a creature, and he isn't responsible to God, his creator. He is only responsible to himself. Now, he is not responsible to God because he is himself God. To the extent that he has any being, he has divine being. And why should he then worry about being responsible to God? There is no creator God in the punish system. Nor could there be a redeemer, Christ. You see, there has been lots of arguments in the history of the church whether Platonism is a better foundation for Christianity than Aristotelianism. Now, Aristotelianism is the basis for Roman Catholicism. They have taken the position that Aristotle's methodology is the best methodology there is as a foundation for the Christian position. Now, don't you see? It doesn't make any difference. We shall see in a moment when we discuss Aristotle. But I just want to first finish Plato. That is to say, here's non-being of which there's absolutely no knowledge. Here's some being, where we are, of which there is right opinion, death knowledge. Not real scientific knowledge. Scientific true knowledge is of absolute true being. That's up there. That's above any man, above any individual. That for us is an ideal to strive for. We'll never reach it until we are beyond self-conscious individual existence, when we are no longer here in this world, when after our death and we're reabsorbed, then we shall know as we are known, because we are no longer there as individuals. Well, that whole thing is mysticism. It's being separated from God metaphysically, and individuality is therefore at the same time evil. But you see, it's bad to be in the body, because in the body you are separate from your true being. And all it isn't only bad that you steal and murder and commit adultery and all of that sort of thing, but it's bad in the sense that you're in the body. This is the source, of course, of all the mysticism and of all the asceticism and of all the false asceticism, which is the body is bad, and marriage is bad, and all of that sort of thing. We must lift ourselves higher up in the scale of being and get away from that. And that's the primacy of the intellect. The intellect is not sinful. Neither is, of course, the will sinful in the biblical sense. The will of man hasn't sinned against the law of God, such as we're told about in the Genesis account. But just the same, you can be willful, you can be stubborn, but so far as your intellect is concerned, you are divine. And what's wrong with being divine? You couldn't sin if you wanted to. You just simply are part of the eternal changeless being. Now, are there any... Yes?
Would you differentiate in a definition between the being of man and the being of God? How would we explain this, say, to a group of college students?
The Christian position, you mean? Well, you don't explain it. I mean, you just say that the Bible says we are creatures made in the image of God. Now, if you're going to give a definition of that, well, the only definition of God is accumulation of material on the basis of which the West mentions God is experienced and eternal unchanging, and so forth. Now, that isn't a definition in Aristotle's sense of the term, because it doesn't claim to penetrate exhaustively through the reality of that which it defines. If you take a definition in Parmenides' sense of the term, you, by your intellect, must be able to penetrate reality and describe it exhaustively. Here's the big class, here's the subclass, and here's the subclass under that. Now this is individual thing, this is the species, the infimat species, here's the genus, and there's the larger genus. And then finally you get the one under which all is subsumed. Now strictly speaking, that's the requirement of a definition in Aristotle's sense of the term. But we can't give that, we don't pretend to give it. We give, in our definition of God, we're giving a description of what the Bible tells us. But God is incomprehensible in the sense that we can never exhaustively penetrate Him. Therefore, we can't give a definition of God or a definition of man in the Aristotelian sense. You take the totality view and you say, this is what I receive on authority. Very well. You don't like it. Very well. So then you start explaining life to me. Well, he says, I want a definition. I want to see through this thing. How you relate, because he says, creation out of nothing is contradictory. And nothing that is contradictory, he says, can be true. Because Parmenides says, I can by thought think through ultimate reality. Reality must be that which I can think that it must be. Now, the assumption there is that my intellect is the same intellect as the divine intellect. It has legislative, internally, inherently legislative powers, and it rightfully claims that for itself, and it rejects every position, such as the Christian position. That's the only position it rejects, finally. Because then man is said that it is said to be only a creature, and that his intellect is that of a creature, and that his intellect shouldn't legislate for reality, but should seek to understand this world, which is given it to understand by God. Now, it's a choice between two totality pictures. You can't make any part of this plain to a non-Christian without having him take the whole thing. Therefore, he either takes this thing in toto or this thing in toto.
So when you say, all right, we're not going to say that there's a unity of being, but my existence and your existence and God's existence are different, but it's the creator-creature idea that you bring out most of all right there.
Yeah.
So that we are not infinite, eternal, unchangeable.
Yeah. Now, he, of course, would also grant that he's not infinite. But then he'd say, I'm still of the same substance. God is infinite. By that, he would mean reality is bigger than I am as an individual. But the point is that he claims that what reality he has got is of the same substance precisely as other, all realities. All right, other questions? Well, let's for the moment then go on to Aristotle. We'll come back to Plato again eventually. Well, now, the difficulty with Aristotle's position, as he himself realized to an extent, and as he speaks of it in some of his later dialogues, is this dualism between this wholly other, timeless, changeless world of which none of us can individually have any knowledge except that we are absorbed in it. And if we're absorbed in it, then we aren't we anymore to have knowledge of it. And here's the non-being. And we are here a cross between pure non-being and pure absolute eternal being, a mixture of the two. We are. Now, how do you make a definition of man in terms of pure, unknown being, which is wholly above you, where your real being is supposed to be, and your individuality, which derives from this non-being, which is way down here. In other words, none of us experience non-being. That's below anything that we see. None of us see absolute being. That's beyond everything. We are explained as individuals in terms of two principles, both of which are absolutely beyond us. The one upward above us and the other downward below us. Well, that dualism, it was that Aristotle starts with. He says, what in the world? Now, he went to school with Plato for 20 years. And after you've been in class with a person for 20 years, you ought to understand his position pretty well. So he said to his teacher, and he always remained faithful to the principles of Plato. In other words, what Aristotle taught isn't a change of position in any basic sense. It is certainly not a return to the creator-creature distinction. That is out. That isn't even talked about in polite society among the Greeks. It is taken for granted that you must understand reality and see through it exhaustively. And if you don't, then there is no knowledge, don't you see? Well, so Aristotle says, look, you have introduced this other world, haven't you, Mr. Plato? This other world, this ideal world. And here's Sparkplug and Jenny and Maggie, the individual Nag. One is Evie, the other has Fathom. But the real horse, the horse, or horseness, is up there. Here is this girl. Now, I thought she was pretty nice, but then I dropped her. She wasn't that. My ideal girl is up there. The ideal girl, which all of us want to marry, but none of us actually. What is the use of this? What on earth, and this is what he said literally, what on earth is the use of introducing that other world as a source of explanation for this world, since you can't explain the relationship between the two worlds? Now, that was Aristotle's question. Well, he was right. So what did he say? How are we to approach it then? We mustn't have that, start from that ideal world, say that's the only real world. We start right here with Socrates, he said, and here's Simeon. Or Simeon's or Stevie's, or Callius, or any of his friends. Now, there, down here, here's an homage to goodness, individual man. And that's why we're going to read about Aristotle having introduced the empiricistic approach over against the rationalistic approach. Or that he is, therefore, interested in starting right in this world with the facts which everybody has before him and which everybody knows about. And it needs no assumption. He's got something solid under his feet to start from. Let's not start with principles over there. So then, don't you see, when Socrates and Callius, and I said yesterday he's 250 pounds and snub nose, Callius is 150 pounds and non snub nose. Now, when they meet down here in this world, Heraclitus, they just bang around each other just like a couple pieces of ice in an ocean, you know, with currents and so forth. Now, there's got to be some sense of, there must therefore be some relation of this individual to the eternal. And so Socrates says, Aristotle says, we have here to be sure non-being, but we don't call it non-being in that sense. We call it potentiality because it isn't absolute non-being. And we don't call this absolute being, we call this actuality. And therefore there's a gradational difference. There isn't this absolute dualism between one changeless being and one absolutely changing being down here. It's a gradational. Just like, suppose that you have a straight up staircase. I saw by the building construction, I saw one brother climbing up that straight ladder, and I don't want to go up there. Now, however, if they build a step like that, don't you see, then maybe I would go to the top too, if they make a step easy enough. Well, so what Aristotle wants to do, he wants to make a series of easy steps between this world here and the other. Now, he says, we have four causes. All the things that we know have material in them. Now, I walked in wooden shoes in Holland, and when your wooden shoes are worn out, you got to have a pair of new ones, and you go to a wooden shoemaker, as I did once upon a time. And a wooden shoemaker takes a block of wood. Now that's the material cause. Now that hasn't much shape, it has some form. You never see pure wooden. You just see a piece of willow wood or a piece of poplar wood. It has some measure of form already in anything that you experience here in the world. Nevertheless, relatively speaking, compared to the nice wooden shoe, which I pretty soon walk home with, that is the raw material. And then there is the moving cause. That is to say, the action that starts this thing towards taking more shape and more form, and then you have the formal cause. That is, I have an idea in my mind what a wooden shoe should be. And then I have the final cause, namely, I want to make the wooden shoes for this little greenhorn, that boy who has to wear them and go to the Christian school in them. Now, that is the material, the efficient, as he calls them, and the formal and the final causes, all of which are stages between pure potentiality and pure actuality. Now, that the totality outlook is an attempt, you see, to overcome this dualism that's in Plato, to make for a gradational, gradual understanding. In other words, his fundamental position is like that of Plato. He says knowledge is of universals only. Really, I am certainly starting from the individual Socrates, the man. But don't you see, when I start from Socrates and from Pelias, I want to say something about both of them that is true of both of them. I have to give a definition. Here's your question again of definition. Of who is Socrates? Well, all I can say is Socrates is a man. What can I say about Pelias? He's a man. When I go and describe Socrates individually, he's snub-nosed, and Xanthippe is his wife, and when I describe Pelias, he's 150 pounds, he's not snub-nosed, and Mary is his wife, I don't know what his name, wife's name was, then that's all accidental, don't you see? That's not of the essence of the matter. When I define, I got to give a universal that is true of him in terms of a concept. Germans call it Begriff, a concept. Not a percept. A percept is what I, with my senses, with my eyes, ears, and so forth, I catch together empirically, gather up new things. But the concepts are the universal law or species in terms of which I relate these individual percepts, and I can manipulate them. I can, here I have all kinds of little figures which I call potatoes. Well, I can put them in 100-pound bags. I can universalize them. I can, on the stock market, I get them out so completely universalized so that the whole stock administration on the stock market is, of course, done quite independently, seemingly, of all these little individual facts. And yet they deal, the stock market deals with the individual, rearranges and sales and so forth. So here, what he is trying to do is to say the individual has, first of all, pure matter in him. And then there is a cause in eternal motion. In other words, things are not changeless, eternal changeless beings. There is a change, eternal motion. Now, that's not creation. That's not creation out of nihilo. Don't you see? It is an eternally self-existent source of movement, the exact opposite of creation out of nothing. Now, yet the Roman Catholic Church has to combine this notion of an eternal motion, not created, a moving force in all reality, with the Christian notion of creation. Now, that's the problem for Roman Catholics, that they have to splice together two such absolutely exclusive concepts as that characterizes all their thinking. Well, now, this is the eternal matter, not creation out of nothing. So you see, every point in Aristotle's doctrine is absolutely exclusive of the Christian position, just as absolutely exclusive as this Platonism. And then the form. Now, the formal cause is what? Well, we say the formal cause in the Christian position is that God simply says, this is going to be it. This is what I want that to be, and this is how I want this to differ from that. And I take my ideas from myself, drop up and look up to a form. A fairly easy illustration is, if a lady makes a dress, well, here she has the material, she has the goods, first of all, the material, you call it. Isn't that right, Mrs. Fowler? Call it material, right? Well, that's what my wife told me. Now, then She gets the sewing machine, and there's a movement, a terrific movement. That's the efficient movement. And then there's the pharmacos she has in mind, the dress she wants to make. All right, so she has a pattern, and that lies out there before her, a pattern. And then, what for? Well, a graduation dress. My daughter's going to graduate from the Christian high school this spring. So I want to make her a graduation. Or my daughter's going to get married. I want to make her a wedding dress. Now, that's the final, that is the ultimate, the goal. But everything, you have to have the material. You have to have the movement. If it weren't for the movement, the material would lie there forever, unchanged, be no different from any other material. I was to the Orient a number of years ago, and I took some material along for a dress for my granddaughter and my daughter-in-law. All right? They produced the motion. You see, I just took the material which I bought in Tokyo. I brought that as one aspect of it. They produced the substance, and then my daughter and granddaughter, they wore it after that. Well, now, this is how all reality is explained. These are aspects. Now, here's pure actuality. This is the final product, but we never see this. This is always beyond us. This is down here, is always. Pure non-being, nobody sees. What you actually see is a combination of these four causes. Now, something is always on the way. Therefore, you have image, material, you have movement, you have a pattern, and you have a purpose. Now, that explains the whole of reality, all of human life. Don't you see? The lowest is down here, the matter. And then the higher in the scale of being you get, you have the material, and finally there's the final cause for everything. There's purpose in it all. There's a teleology through nature. I don't know if some of you know Dr. Ryan's book, for instance, on the Bible and science. Some of you know that. Who knows that? Well, Dr. Ram is trying to combine, as I understand it, some sort of teleological concept of nature, the way the Roman Catholics have it, Thomas Aquinas, with the idea of science. Well, I think it's a futile effort myself, because you can't tie on this kind of purpose or teleology of nature. The Christian teleology says God, for his own glory, has created and has ordained and sent his Son into the world to redeem from sin. That's his purpose. Whereas in this case, you have one being. You wipe out first the creator-creature distinction. And then you say, being has in it various elements, and it has in it a tendency towards something higher and higher, and that's teleology. Now, this brings us then to the question of Roman Catholicism. Are there any questions so far?
You know, I haven't come to Aristotle a lot, but I've played the analogy of the cave. And the idea that what we see here is the shadows of the real.
All right, here's the cave, and here we are. And we are here, he says, like all those people. You remember the story of the cave? We sit here and we're chained about our neck like this, and we look into the cave, he says, and the sun shines from above us and back us. And there on an elevation there are figures walking, and they cast shadows on the walls, and they are speaking together, and we hear the echoes, and we see the shadows. Now, so that's like all of us human beings. We're really in a cave. Everything is ultimately darkness in one sense. But then somebody, one of those cave dwellers, somehow got out of the cave. And this one that comes out, it doesn't explain how he got out. You see, that just happened accidentally. You mustn't ask questions about how that has happened. But he came out of the cave. He's up there and he saw the light. And then we went back into the cave, and here they were sitting with chains on their necks. And one of, here, let's call him Miller. Now, Miller got out of the cave, saw things for what they really were in the light of the sun, and he saw the colors, and he saw the azaleas, and he saw saw everything beautiful. And then he had to go back, and he told them down there about that world of light. And what did they say? Did they believe him? Did they believe him? No. They said, up he went, down he came, and he's just the same as he always was. Well, that's the way it was. That is to say, in Christianity, when you are born again, you have seen the light, and then you go back to the cave dwellers, the natural man. Because in our case, the cave dwellers, I'll come to Aristotle in a minute. With us, the cave dwellers are the sinners. And man has taken his own eyes off spiritually. He's blind spiritually. But Christ has come into the world, and he didn't come here by accident. And he doesn't take us out by accident, out of the cave, but he sends his spirit into the cave, and he gives us light. He said to Lazarus, I say unto thee, arise from the tomb, from the cave, so to speak, and I will give you light. And then he enables us to see and to understand, not exhaustively, but here, in this case. The assumption is that man must know exhaustively and comprehensively, or he doesn't know at all. He has to be, therefore, participant with that eternal, changeless being of God, eternal, changeless life, which is up there. And now he's in a cave, he's in darkness. Now that cave is darkness because it's finitude. You see? The evil is not due to a fall, is not ethical, is not because of sin. The darkness of the cave dwellers, their blindness, is due to, well, it's like mold. Here are the moles and the bats. Now here are the moles. Let's just take the bats and the kids. They're more likely to be in a cave. Now, these bats are blind. Now, they can't fall, but they did not fall. There was no fall, no bat fall. Falling bats, either prehistorically or historically. Therefore, we don't say that they, you are totally depraved, you miserable bat. You are the wrath and curse of God, you miserable bat. We don't say anything like that to the bat. That is to say, on this non-Christian basis, don't you see, man isn't supposed to be guilty. It's all a helplessness and a hopelessness because man is just out of luck. Reality is just constituted this way. The whole of reality is not what the Christian position says it is, but it's the exact opposite. Well, now, then the difference between Aristotle and Plato is not in the nature of the case of basic difference. You see, we have to go to these poor Platonists and say, well, my dear friend, you Platonists, it's too bad that you can change your total outlook. You mustn't think of an eternal self-existent being which is all changeless and is light and the changing and darkness over here. You must think of yourself as a creature and the world is created. Now, then the reason for your blindness is not that you're out of luck and you don't see at all if the situation is much worse than you think it is. I think of that passage that Paul speaks of in Rome or in Corinthians. Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? Where are the wise? Where are the scribes? Hath not God made foolish their wisdom? Well, what Paul is trying to tell them, or what he is telling them, is that they are, because of this fall of man, are seeking in vain for light. They have the light within them so far as they are created in the image of God, but they're holding it under. And this is their construction, their philosophical effort. By means of that, they can get no light. Well, then they will forever stay in the cave. There is no escape to this light at all. Well, now, Plato, then, has these people in the cave. How does he get them out? Well, he gets them out by accident. And they actually never get out because they come back in again. How does Aristotle get them out? Well, he says, look here. You aren't actually in this cave. You are already involved. You're on a staircase that leads upwards. And you must think of yourself as going and as moving upwards. And therefore, you're representing yourself in terms of two principles. Dialectical situation, pure non-being, but also pure being. Now, here you have pure being by itself, and here you have non-being, and they are two separate from one another, two dualistically opposed to one another. Now, Aristotle moves them together dialectically. And he says, therefore, people that are in the cave, they're all coming out. They're gradually coming out because that's only the lower aspect of them. The higher aspect, which is also in them, is that they have light built into them, partly. Now, that was really also Plato's position, you see. He says, we are really, to the extent that we have intellect, we are divine. But the cave is only contained through that lower aspect, so you see, and consequently, so far as man is intellect, he's got light in him, and he doesn't need any redemption. Paul therefore tells the priest, things are much worse than you thought of them as being. Because you have sinned and you are under the wrath of God and you're headed for eternal destruction. In your view, nobody is headed for eternal destruction. Nobody has sinned. Nobody is guilty. Nobody is therefore under the wrath of God. But on the other hand, Paul also says, things are much better than any of you have ever thought of them. Because on this basis, whether you have Plato or whether you have Aristotle, the thing is finally hopeless. There is no escape from the cave. Here on the Christian basis, man is to be sure, he's taken out his own eyes, and he's a sinner, but Christ has come to redeem from sin. And the world is ultimately having evil built into it. God, the Creator, Redeemer, is in control. And he is able to establish his kingdom, and Christ does establish the kingdom, and the powers of hell cannot prevail against it. Now you see, first you tell the Greeks that things are far, far worse than they are. Then you say, how much better? Because they are not willing to admit that man is totally depraved in the Christian sense at all. He is just metaphysically out of luck. That's all. It's the metaphysical out of luckness that is here, that you're in the cave. And therefore, if you're saved, you're saved sort of by accident. Accident. If this man came out of the cave by accident. But he also go back. And therefore, the whole scheme of salvation is, as the Christian position has it, doesn't fit in with it.
Does Aristotle ever indicate any incentive or reward for going up that ladder?
Well, everybody is going up. It's like the moving staircase in the department store. You don't need incentive. Well, I mean, you're moving, aren't you? I mean, without your effort on your part. It's auto-socialism. Self-salvation, not by accident. Now, what I do oftentimes, if I'm impatient, I walk up those steps even when the movement is going. My wife doesn't. She thinks that's foolish. She stays put. She has a lot more sense, and she gets there 1 second later than I do. And then I wait and I pump, waiting for her. Don't you see how senseless? Well, women have a lot more sense than men in those things. Any other questions?
I'm still hazy on the relationship of being between the creature and the creator. What is the relationship you have being as far as Aristotle going from pure matter to actuality? What is the Christian position of being as far as our relationship between the creature which we are and the creator?
Well, we have created being. We don't have the same sort of being. We don't have a little bit of divine being. In other words, that's what I meant by the illustration. My nickel is worth it. Much as LBJ, same sort of stuff. With us, we are, God is an eternal changeless being. We are created changeless beings. There are two kinds of beings, creative being, creature being, dependent, derivative. Therefore, we are to take commandments from God, and we are to love Him. In other words, our being isn't just that much less of the same being. Is that not plain? I don't know quite what your problem is. I thought that wouldn't be so difficult. That is, that on the non-Christian basis, you wipe this out and you say, God is from a leaf. He's in God. Now, then we're a bit of the ooze that is oozed out. It's the same sort of stuff. But on the Christian basis, we're not the same sort of stuff. We are created by the will of God on a created level. Now, that's temporal. We're subject to change. We don't have eternity built in us in the sense that we're not little bits of eternal self-existent beings. And that's why we're in every respect dependent upon God's prior interpretation of it. He gives us his orders, and we are to obey, we are to love. And that's why he can save us. On this basis, there is no saving. On the non-Christian basis, on Plato or Aristotle, there isn't any such thing as salvation of man's being. God couldn't save you on that basis. He says, if you were on this basis, you said, look, oh, I'm horribly miserable because I'm so near non-being. Don't you see? God would say, yes, I've got the same coming age as you have. Because I've got non-being in me too. I can't do anything about it. God isn't even a self-conscious being. He hasn't created you. He has no power to redeem you. He has no initiative over you in any sense.
Well, that's kind of a modification of Plotinus in the fountain when the pure beings kind of emanated in the different elements.
Very good.
I mean, is this a modification of that type of idea?
What I just now said about Plato and Aristotle. Oh, well, Plotinus goes beyond them, of course. Now, let's talk about Plotinus a minute and finish off. Plotinus lived in the Christian era, right? About in the 3rd century, am I right? I mean, certainly in the early Christian era. He lived for St. Augustine. Now, we talk about New Platonism. Let's talk about, for a minute, about what happened later on, what schools of philosophy there were. At the time of Paul, there were the Stoics, and what else? The Epicureans, and the Platonists, and the Aristotelians. There were, when Paul was on earth, then he had these four schools of philosophy. You remember, it actually mentions the Stoics and the Epicurean philosophy? Well, there were two others, the Platonists. Now, they had by this time, all of them got skeptics. We saw a while ago that the Sophists, they took the skeptical position, since the greatest philosophers couldn't know reality, so they took the position man is the measure. Well, now by this time, false time, the Stoics and the Epicureans and the Platonists and the Aristotelians were all skeptical, and they were therefore all also what is called ethical. That is to say, they said, well, theoretical, metaphysically, epistemologically, we can't know ultimate reality, but let's just behave well so that we can get along with one another practically in this world. And therefore, they were universalistic. That is, it said, there's nobody that knows any more than anybody else, and all nations are equally good. The idea of the man, the universal man. All right? This was in the early Christian, the Hellenistic period, so called. The Hellenistic period. Which is the late Greek or early Christian period. And then at the climax of early Christian thinking, when we have Plotinus, the latest great Greek philosopher, what he does is he combines together Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics and all that is Greek, except the Epicureans, because they are bad, he thinks they're materialists. But he's particularly interested in getting the benefit out of Plato. Now, his notion is that, therefore, of the scale of being. Aristotle went like that. He talked about the analogy of being. Analogy of being. By that, Aristotle meant that being is not the sort of thing that Plato says. This is static, and this is changing. But he says there is change, and there is permanence in all being. That's what he means. Are meant by being as analogical. It has the Roman Catholics later on put that together by saying there's equivocism in being and there's univocism. There's logic and there's group factuality. And the whole thing is sort of a mixture. Now, what this really means, therefore, a gradual climbing up. Man, with his existence, you see, being very little, very small, and significant, he can, as it were, participate in this, and he gets higher and higher in the scale of being. Well, that scale of being idea is what Plotinus has, and it's basically similar to Platonism. That's why it's called Neoplatonism. And it is the attempt to say, well, look here, all reality is one. In other words, the basic Greek monistic assumption that there is no creator-creature distinction, but all is basically one, and that the only difference between God and man is that we are nearer to non-being than God is. Now, therefore, what salvation is to be lifted in the scale of being. It's sort of a lift idea. And it's a gradual process. You go higher and higher, and you get the more universal, and you get the higher universal, and finally you get to the purely unspeakable one. You can say nothing of it. Now, that is already true in the whole of Greek philosophy. Here's the individual. We'll say that here's the two-legged chicken. Now, here's the quadruped, the cow. Well, pretty soon you don't talk about having legs at all. You just say animal life and inanimate life. You forget about all the legs. How many do they have? Two or four? And then you have, pretty soon you get down to the idea of being, which is a broader, higher concept, and you forget about animality and inanimality. And you finally get to the final one. Now, Aristotle has that one, which he calls thought, thinking itself. Now, that God is the God of Greek monotheism. And Dorywer, in his book, speaks about the Greek form matter scheme. You have down here, you have matter, up there, there is form. And they are correlative to one another. But the form is attained by the way of negation, by dropping this, by dropping that, and finally, not you get up there, because if you're up there, you wouldn't know that you were up there. But the point is that there is, ultimately, above everything else, there is some principle that's anonymous, that has no name at all. That's ultimate reality. Now, that ultimate reality overflows, and is good. Bonum, it is the good, bonum est diffusum. It is inherently diffuse. That is to say, it overflows, and that's the point you're making. God naturally wants to express himself beyond himself, and so he gives being, makes human beings that participate in his being. And since they participate in his being is in them, and it's the same sort of being, and therefore all being is good. Except that being down here, it also has a certain amount of evil in it. God himself is pure, absolutely good being, and when you get down here, get lower, there's a mixture of evil. It's unavoidable. It's just like the storms in the desert, sand that blows through your, in your clothes, and gets in your hair, and your eyes. How can you help it? But inherently, that whole being you attain, you go upward by way of negation. That's why mysticism, negative theology, the way of negation, gets you out of this world. Now, that's essentially Plato. But Plotinus carries that through, that motif, until he gets, well, now that other has to be a sort of explanation for this. And so he says, that, whatever it is, we know nothing of it. But it is him. It is good, and as good, it is diffuse. It runs over. It bubbles over. Now, we are down here, and we are therefore participant in that being, in the overflow of God's being. And therefore, we are also divine. We are also good. But we are, though we are also good so far as we have been, we also, since we are so far away from that original source of good and divine being, we have a mixture within us of less good and of still less good and finally of no good. Not that anybody is absolutely no good. There's no total depravity, of course. Now, that is the latest and the final point of view of Greek philosophy as it was expressed by the Neoplatonists, and particularly as it was set forth in the Aeneid of Plotinus.
Did he give personality or perfection? Did he actually give an attribute to this unspeakable one that overflows?
No, he said that's anonymous. Did I understand your question?
Yes.
I mean, it is wholly unknowable and unknown. Sure, you get there by not this, not that, obligation. We'll talk about negative theology and its results coming into the Christian church. Thank you.